This is Kyle Worley. I'm joined by my co-host Jen Wilkin and JT English. How are we doing, y'all?
It's not been great.
No, it's not. I feel like we're at a tipping point. Like, I feel like this is a breaking point in our relationship. JT has been
chewing audibly into the microphone
and trolling.
I did it once, and it was who brought the coffee cake in?
It wasn't me. It was Ryan.
Ryan, thank
production.
You.
Thank you,
it's
Ryan.
It's really good coffee.
Exec cake. Producer Ryan.
I just had a bite.
Yeah, right
in the middle of.
I don't think it's as bad as you think it was.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, for all the listeners out there that can hear JT smacking,
I'm sorry.
Please at JT English.
Let me apologize. I did not know you could hear it, but I do want to thank Ryan that it was good coffee cake.
Oh, there we go. Well, Ryan brought some good coffee cake. And on today's episode, we get a chance to chat with. How did you like that turn right there?
That's really good.
I'm a professional. On today's episode, we get a chance to chat with Mark Sayers about his new book, The Reappearing Church. Mark is a cultural commentator, writer, speaker, highly sought after for his unique and perceptive insights into faith and contemporary culture. He's a pastor in Melbourne, Australia. He's written a number of books. We talk about two of those books in particular today, The Disappearing Church and The Reappearing Church. I thought it was an interesting conversation.
Yeah, thrown in was the cool accent. So
yes, I mean, yeah. anything
no,
in an accent.
He's
fascinating.
He's one of those guys whose his insights are just like, it feels like he's putting his thumb right on the topic and issue. He's not talking around something, but literally right on it.
I agree. So we hope you enjoy the discussion. All right. So we have Mark Sayers on the line. Mark, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
That's great. Now, where are you calling in from, Mark?
I'm in my home in Melbourne, Australia.
Okay.
We're recording here in Dallas, Texas at 4.07 p.m. Mark, what time is it there?
It's 7.07 a.m. The next day. So I'm technically in the future.
You're in the future.
In the future.
I can't imagine recording a podcast at 7 a.m. That would be... It would be bad for me. It'd be bad for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that it would probably, your breath would definitely smell worse than it does right now.
Ouch, Kyle. You've said a lot of things about me before, but that one.
Well, I'm just saying your breath has a tendency to get progressively better through the day.
It's the coffee.
Mm-hmm, that's what it is. Yeah. It's like, we love the coffee smell. Mark, are you coffee or tea? Is that what's your drink of choice in the morning?
Definitely coffee. Yeah, I drink. I mean, I like tea, but definitely begin with coffee. Okay. Is the way to start, particularly if you're from Melbourne.
Oh, really? Is that like a...
Coffee's a big deal in Australia.
Really?
I had no idea until I went.
Okay.
Wow.
Did you go to Melbourne? Were you in Melbourne?
I was in Sydney.
Okay.
But, man, it's good coffee. And apparently it's the Italian influence. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, there's two influences. So Melbourne's sort of the hub of it. So you had the Italians bring the espresso machines in the 50s. But really, really interestingly, you had a temperance movement in Melbourne just at the end of the 19th century, in the beginning of the 20th century. And that's why they created all these coffee houses. So that's sort of, you can actually thank evangelicalism for good coffee in Melbourne, which very few people know.
Praise the Lord.
Man, God does work in mysterious ways.
And I've been looking for things to thank evangelicalism for lately,
right,
so that's good to add to my list.
is the coffee presence in Australia. Well, listen, I know I said this off air before we jump on, but Mark is a noted author. He is a cultural commentator. He's written a number of books. I listed them off the introduction, but I just got to say, and I told you this off air, that Vertical Self, which I think is what was that your first book, Mark, or an early book?
Second, yeah.
Okay, so Vertical Self was a book that Mark wrote that at the right time, I found that book, or that book found me, and just was so helpful. And so it's a real treat to have you on today, talking specifically about your most recent book, which is The Reappearing Church. You get that title right? The Reappearing Church.
Yes, Reappearing Church, yeah.
Yeah. So where did the church go, Mark? Like, I think of appearance and reappearance and disappearance language as the language of a magician. So if the church is reappearing, has it disappeared? So maybe before we jump in to talk about this book, we might need to kind of set as a precursor, from where is the church reappearing and where has it been?
Well, I wrote a book... called Disappearing Church. And I think that was really trying to capture a sense around 2015. I just sensed this profound sort of almost atmosphere of anxiety around the future of the church. I think what happened at that moment, particularly in the United States, was the reality of post-Christianity really began to bite. I think probably in places like Australia that had been around a while longer, But there was this sense that we started to see, I think particularly with emerging generations, that they weren't being discipled in the way that we'd hoped. The statistics in some denominations started coming through. So I just began to, I guess, capture that sense of what did it feel like? Like, hang on, this thing's disappearing. So it was, in a sense, it was a wake-up call. And then with this book, I really felt the Lord sort of challenged me to reframe that and to look at this particular, you know, moment in time in the West as what if this is the kind of moment where God actually wants to do a new thing? And what if you want to reframe that fear and anxiety about the future of the church or, you know, what's happening in the culture, actually is the kind of moment where God tends to renew his church.
Yeah. So what are some of those, what are the things that are generating a lot of heat or a lot of that anxiety? What do you feel like are the panic-inducing things that have emerged around the quote-unquote disappearing church? What are the things that make us anxious? Is it the removal of social or political power, or is it influence? Is it the degradation of institutions of trust? I mean, what do you feel like in your study, what is the anxiety? What's the principal concern?
Yeah, I mean, the first one is just that this shrinkage of the church in the West is a statistical reality. My denomination and churches here in Melbourne are, you've got a few which are growing, but the majority are shrinking, and that's happening all across the West. And so there's just that reality, number one, of just less people engaged in their faith, going to church. The second one is you're seeing also a weakening of institutions across the board. You talk at different seminaries and different Christian parachurch organizations, denominations, there is a sense that there is a weakening. The third thing I would say too is there's an increased flip in how a switch, if you like, how the culture perceives the church. For a lot of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, there was a sense where the Christians were the moral people and, you know, like people stayed away from the church because they saw the church as too moral. There's been this really interesting switch in the culture in the last, I think, particularly 5 years, where increasingly the church is not seen as too moral, it's actually seen as immoral. And there's almost this principled step that people take when they step out of engagement with Christian faith. And then I think that the last one is an ability of culture to profoundly influence people within the church. Like there was a dynamic before where you could have this Christian posture towards the culture, which was one of retreat. Fundamentalism and essentially was a retreat from the world. But it's really interesting with globalization, with technology, with our culture is everything that's far, used to be far, is now close. That you can have a kid, say, who goes to a Christian, you know, school, who is homeschooled, who goes to a church, but their cell phone is discipling them in their bedroom. Mm-hmm. So there's this element that we realize that the ability for culture to shape people in ways that are opposite to the gospel is incredibly powerful right now. And I think the fact that those almost a feeling across the West that those protections that the church had in culture are actually disappearing or possibly under pressure at the moment.
Mark, one of the things I've heard you talk about before that you just mentioned there that I'd love to see you tease out in terms of kind of this big idea of what's happening in our cultural moment is, I think the category you've used in the past is progressivism, the new Phariseeism, and this kind of move that you just talked about of, because I became a Christian about 15 years ago, received social capital, was seen as somebody that was in line with kind of the cultural trends, but then immediately all of a sudden I'm now supposedly out, you know, because I'm a Christian, I'm somebody who is seen as not a moral person, I think was a language that you used. And that has been something that's just been radically disorienting, not only for me, but I think for the church, when you're supposed to, the institution that you've been a part of as a church is actually, and in some parts of the West still, that's still true. We live in Dallas, Texas, and that's still probably partially true here, but that's certainly not true from where I was from in Denver, where the church used to be something that was contributing to the flourishing of the community, is now seen as something that is actually contributing to the disintegration of human flourishing. Is that kind of what you're trying to say?
Yes, I think there's been a profound shift of mood, particularly in the United States. In Australia, there's always been a much longer suspicion around religion, and I'd always find it when I would come to the United States and be on a plane next to someone, or even checking into a hotel and just talking to the people behind the counter, that I'd almost be bracing myself when I mentioned that I'm a pastor, that there would be this reaction. And I was always shocked in America when there wasn't a reaction at times. But I think, like, you guys have sort of caught up to where we're at, and perhaps even in a more intense way.
And
I think
so
one
quickly.
Of the big things in culture, it happened very quickly. And I think what happened is, you know, particularly in the 1970s, there was an intensification of both the American left and right, which has taken the American left and right, it started to take on a more radical form. And that's slowly been playing out, but it's taken a real intensity now where, in a sense, I think what happened with post-Christianity, people's search for meaning doesn't disappear. It is recast onto something, and particularly around politics. The reaction to Christianity and some of the political choices of American evangelicalism, it came home to roost in a very powerful way that is felt just even when you're on the street or interacting online with people.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting because when you talk about that mapping of meaning onto something, that like it's going to go somewhere, this is one of my... what feels like just pastorally right now, what feels so pressing and yet can feel quite a bit paralyzing, which is that these different kind of ideological streams that have roots that go beyond the present moment, right? I mean, like a lot of the things that we're talking about as plaguing the church or as temptations for the church or as areas of capitulation for the church, these are not things that in their substance are incredibly novel, but they are hitting the church in the global West in particular when radical individualism has so set in. It's like so firmly entrenched. And so that's one of the questions I had for you is how does Christian witness flourish when everyone is convinced they're an autonomous silo? Like how do you even get the conversation going when everybody is been really like enculturated, acclimated to this idea of the radically autonomous self? Because it seems like regardless of political ideology, it seems like as that middle has fallen out, there are as many opportunities and there are as many kinds of distinctions as there are selves and people. Where do you even start when it seems like everybody is an island unto themselves? And how can the church's witness be uniquely captivating and persuasive in the midst of that kind of autonomy?
Well, I think this is one of the points of opportunity that I'm trying to point out to people in this book. If you look at the West, there's a series of intensifications of individualism. I think about my grandfather who grew up in a working class neighborhood. You know, he wasn't a believer, but he was part of a trade union. He knew the people in his neighborhood. And so that's almost the first wave of individualism. So still individualism. He wasn't connected to a faith community, but you had these loose associations which gave you a sense of social cohesion and embeddedness. Then you push that forward, that just starts to slowly ebb away. Now, I reckon a lot of my ministry was in a time of individualism, but it was like the full effect of that individualism hasn't hit home. So, mm-hmm. You know, after my grandfather, you saw this intensification in the 60s, and then, you know, even from the 90s to the early 2000s, there was this sense of like, hey, I can do what I want. The world had this very optimistic tone, particularly from the fall of the Berlin Wall. It started to get hit with 9/11 and then the global financial crisis. But there was this period was like, hey, the world's our oyster. We can just travel. The internet's going to connect us. The internet's going to provide this social lattice that will give us a sense of meaning but still preserve our individual autonomy. But I think what's happened in the last 3 years is the full intensification, particularly since the advent of, you know, it's almost the second act of the iPhone and the second act of social media, is you're seeing a social isolation of an increased intensification that is now hurting all across the West. The city of Hamburg in Germany, I think it's like 50% now, people living one person alone. Scandinavia, that's trending up in you know, the downtown of many of America's most influential cities, the single person household is becoming normative. And, you know, this has never happened before. This has only happened before in history when there's been wars and a lot of people have been killed. And you're seeing, like, just in the last few years, the rise in mental health, the rise in isolation. Places like Japan and South Korea are now planning their future welfare government policy on the fact that it'll be what they call loner culture, single people living alone. So what I'm seeing now is people who are coming and are hungry for just some human connection. And no longer does radical American individualism that has been exported to the world, no longer does that look as sexy as it did in the past. It now looks actually restricting and painful. And so there's actually a hunger of people saying, hang on, this is not good. You know, there's an openness now to community. Now, the B side of that is people don't know how to do it. So there's this tremendous hunger for community, but people have not been raised to actually connect with community and connect. So you've got people coming into church going, hang on, I'm hungry for community, but all the ways that they've learned will actually sabotage that.
Yeah.
So I think we need to recognize there's an opportunity, but the second opportunity is similar to what the church did in the late antiquity or the dark ages, is they had to actually form alternate forms of community which taught people again how to order their lives and to live in connection with other people. So I don't think churches are grabbing that. Like I've been thinking there's courses like the Alpha course and these things out there. What would happen if you actually had a course saying, we're going to teach, you know, we're going to maybe share the gospel, but also at the same time, we can actually show you how to actually build a functioning life. Like I wonder whether there's actually some evangelistic opportunities that we're missing that are actually going to start to open up where we you know, preach the gospel to people, but also show them actually how to live that out in community.
Hey, JT, who is your favorite theologian?
You.
That's really
Herman Bovink.
Thank you. Oh, okay. Well, now the truth comes out. Have you been looking at that new Volume 1, Reformed Ethics?
I have. I've maybe read the first few pages. I've not got a lot of time.
I haven't cracked into it either. I haven't read the whole thing. But if, like, all of a sudden, if I was wanting to search all of Bovink's Volume 1 on sin, how long do you think it would take you to read the whole volume just looking for sin?
Just looking for sin?
Just that idea.
Oh, man. Hours?
Hours? Okay. Perhaps. So using Logos Bible software package, which also has incredible theological resources, I just searched the word sin for Volume 1, and I've pulled up every time that Bovink mentioned sin in Volume 1 of that ethic.
That's incredible.
It's incredible. And Logos' searchability function is unbelievable. You can get through a range of material really fast, and they're offering an incredible deal every week for Knowing Faith ministers. If you go to logos.com/knowingfaith, you can enter a contest to win their silver base package, Logos 8. That's $1,000 value. logos.com/knowingfaith to enter that contest.
Okay, so that's the problem out there, but I'm also always seeing everywhere I travel around the problem that's in here. Like, we've got the problem within the church of the lure of the autonomous self, which affects everything from the way that we read scripture to what we expect from a worship service. Do you see the growing trend toward even younger people gravitating back toward liturgical environments or liturgical traditions? Is that a reflection of this growing rejection of the lure of the autonomous self?
I think somewhat. I mean, there's different moments when you see, there's a continual, interest in liturgical forms and higher forms of church, generationally that happens. You know, mm-hmm. You can even go back to the 19th century and, people turning to high Anglicanism and, different things like this. I think the big trend in this is a more disconnected engagement with church, where people see that they belong but are rarely there. So regular attendance becoming, I'm coming every 4 to 6 to even 10 weeks. And I began to notice this a few years ago, where you'd bump into people and you're like, hey, I haven't seen you around church for a while. And they're like, oh, no, I love it. I'm committed there. And then you don't see them for another 10 weeks. Now, in the past, those people would think, I need to go more regularly. But now that's actually seen as a normative way of engaging. And that's because belonging now in the West doesn't mean you actually have to be physically present. So this is a huge challenge that I think, just say you go to church of 1,000 people and people are turning up every 6 to 10 weeks. That means on Sunday you might only have 200 people there, but you've got 1,000 people who belong to your church. And this actually starts to hit at the critical mass sustainability reality for churches. But again, there's an opportunity here that I think when you look at what it is what we're actually seeing is post-Christianity, as we're experiencing it, burns up cultural Christianity. And I actually think there's an opportunity there. Particularly, so many forms of American church growth are centered around corralling and creating programs for cultural Christians. And to be 100% honest, it's actually painful. Like, who wants to try and convince people to just come to this program, to try and come? You know, like, half-committed people are some of the worst people to lead. What I'm seeing,
I've been saying that about my staff team. I mean,
see, Mark, you just set him up too easily for that one, man. Okay, we're gonna have to settle that debt on the other end of this phone call.
But. No, but you said a really important thing. Yeah, JT is mocking it because
I'm not mocking it. I want to stay on it. That's why I wanted to stop.
Half-committed people are some of the hardest people.
There's
to
no
lead.
Doubt, and that's cultural Christianity. Like, there's kind of this.
And we're in the Bible Belt, yeah. So we feel some level of familiarity with.
That's
this.
Right. Keep going, Mark. That's good.
I remember having this conversation like with about week after week. So we got our 5 p.m. service is mostly millennials. And I kept having this conversation. I just would, you know, after I'd preach, just stay down the front and people come and talk to you. And I had the same conversation multiple weeks in a row, which is, hi, I grew up with in a church. Every one of my Christian friends has turned their back on their faith. I'm the last one. And I began to realize that if you're in my 5 p.m. service and you're a millennial, you're actually no longer a cultural Christian because the entire weight of the culture is against you being in church. Hmm. And like I felt the Lord point out to me, like Mark, what you've actually got here is something new. It's actually a remnant. Hmm. Like if you've got a millennial now who's turning up and is like, every one of my Christian friends has lost their faith, but I'm hanging in here and you know, I still love Jesus. That has to change profoundly how you view church. And actually, my encouragement in the book is actually stop looking for hurting cultural Christians. Actually start building a remnant, because increasingly those cultural Christians are actually going to disappear, and also they're disembedded from the church.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I want to ask a little bit about, is there a historical precedent? Is there something that we've seen in the past, Mark, that can shed a little bit of light on the present moment? Like, are we in a completely new wave? And if so, in the global West, is that not true somewhere else? Like, are there brothers and sisters and church leaders around the world that have already walked this path?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first, just a few, and I mean, I think it was Mark Twain who said, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So I think there's a whole bunch of unique realities to this moment. But again, too, history is a really interesting research field to look at. So, you know, first of all, one thing I'd say is when you read the New Testament, you notice these characters who are hanging around the edges of synagogues, the God-fearers.
Yeah.
These are Gentiles who, like, why are they there? They're not Jewish. They don't want to completely convert to Judaism. But you keep seeing them crop up. And part of the reason they're there is the myth of Rome is starting to fall. And the story that Rome told was that it's going to provide this peace. It's going to provide endless glory. It's going to unite the known world. You just have to bow your knee to Caesar. But at the point that, you know, Jesus emerges and the church emerges, you know, it's turning into civil war. It's becoming a parody of itself, and it's a slow decline. But the first thing I would say is that what you're seeing is people drawn to an alternate story that's being lived, that's not as powerful as the bigger culture, but actually it has cut through in the real world. And those God-fearers, in a sense, become the bridge between the Jews and the Gentiles, and the gospel goes out, and you know, many of those people join the church. So I think we're going to increasingly see, I've never heard of this before in my years of ministry. We used to say that people are not just going to turn up to your church, but I know cathedrals around Australia are starting to have people just walk in and just say, I know nothing about this. Can you please tell me what it is to be a Christian? I've never heard of that, but it's starting to happen. We're having people call cold callers who know no Christian background and are saying, there's something happening in the history. So my first question is, who are the God-fearers in this moment? And even migration, people... The gospel is, if you look at the history of the gospel, when humans move around the planet in big numbers, that is a moment of gospel opportunity. In Melbourne here, we have many Persian people who have come from Iran, many have come via places like Malaysia. Many don't, you know, are on refugee, you know, visas. And there's a tremendous move of God happening amongst Persian people, which has never happened in history. They're God-fearers. They're questioning the West, but they're also questioning their country of origin. So that's the first thing. Who are the God-fearers? The second thing is, if you look at the Great Awakenings and revivals of the 18th century, you know, often we can have this faulty view of the West that everyone in, I don't know, 1200 AD went to church and just been this slow decline. It's much more like a roller coaster. And, you know, in the 18th century, we think of people like Jonathan Edwards and Wesley and so on. But just before Wesley, there was a period where literally Britain had, the Enlightenment was happening. People were turning to science and rationality. You know, I think it was St. Paul's Cathedral. I can't remember the exact date or what it was, but St. Paul's Cathedral had an Easter service where six people turned up. You know, you had this actual moment where, like, someone like Charles Simeon, who was, you know, a minister in Cambridge in the 18th century, all his theology lectures were drunk. You know, like, the church was in a bad state. But then all the cultural tumult of the 18th century, the beginnings of globalization that the British Empire was doing in the world, you see that after that, then there is this incredible renewal. And as I looked at the history, I began to realize that whenever the culture's in tumult, whenever there's intensified globalization and people are on the move, leaving what they know behind, you see these moments of renewal. Just when people write the epitaph for the church, that's exactly when the church springs back. James Burns talked about the imagery of, with renewals and revivals, of it's like the surf going out. Like, there's this moment, if you're standing at the beach, the surf comes in, but then you see it go out. And anyone who's been near the beach knows that when it's going out and the longer it goes out, that means behind the breakers, the force is generating and it's going to come back in. And at the moment, it may feel like the surf's going out, but it's going to come back in. It's so important to remember that.
So then, if you were going to give intensely practical advice for the local church, what would be your elevator pitch church growth strategy for those of us staring into the glare of post-Christian America?
The first thing I would say is everything's going to change. And prepare now. Like, prepare now while the surf seems to be going out for the surf to come back in. It's going to look differently. And my sense is there's a humbling going on, particularly in America, with culture and with the church. And what that means is that so many of the different... This is not an elevator pitch, by the way. It's probably gone too long for an elevator already. But... There's a sense where there is going to be a change. And Leslie Newbegin talked about the fact that he talked about secularism coming against all forms of meaning, not just religion, but any form of meaning in which we put our trust that is not God. And you've seen that in the United States. You're seeing that politically. You're seeing that economically. You're seeing that in Me Too, in Hollywood. You're looking at all these different icons and institutions are being humbled. So how do you then create a humble approach to ministry where all the things that we put our trust in apart from God can no longer sustain us? A future which may look leaner but actually pushes back to the gospel. So I'd start preparing that now. I would go deep with a few to prepare for what's going to happen next, and I would start to seek out who are the remnant. Now, really interesting, in the UK, the stats... you know, coming back is that actually atheism has dropped in the last few years. There's some just really interesting initial chats, like 1 in 10 people in London now are going to church. Now, if you look at why is that happening, I think God's doing stuff. But Britain faced the reality of post-Christianity 10, 20, 30 years ago. And across Britain, you've seen the most remarkable prayer meetings where churches are getting together going, like, hang on, we're in trouble here. We need to actually get on our knees and contend. I, last year, attended at Worcester Cathedral this prayer meeting of all the churches in Worcester, every denomination, getting together, worshipping and crying out for God to move again and to renew Britain. That only happens when you get to a certain pain point. So I would say to leaders, understand that the pain point is one to not actually make you freak out and get anxious. It's actually one to push you to your knees and actually turn to God, because you can't do it in your own strength. There's not a strategy here. America is brilliant at strategizing and thinking and talking, but post-Christianity is not going to be solved by thinking, talking, and strategizing. It's going to only be solved by actually what God is doing and actually realizing how weak we are, but how strong He is. And that's the moment. Martin Lloyd-Jones said, when men and women fall on their knees and realize they can't do it, that's when God actually moves. That's way too long for an elevator pitch, but yeah.
That's good, Mark. That's really good.
Mark, I think, yeah, I mean, I'm encouraged by that, because I think instead of saying, hey, here's the tactical move that we think will get us ahead of the power curve of whatever the next movement is, it is just a call to return to the God of the movements of the world, and the one that holds the hearts of the kings in His hands, and the one that guides and directs and builds His church.
One of my favorite quotes from Martin Lloyd-Jones that you're reminding me of is this. It says, when God acts, He can do more in a minute than man can do with organizing in 50 years.
Yeah.
And that's even an understatement, right?
Absolutely.
Just that we are dependent upon God being gracious and merciful and doing what only He can do.
Yeah. Mark, we're grateful for your time. Thank you for jumping on the phone with us. Listen, if you're a listener to Knowing Faith, Mark Sayers has many books. Two of the more recent ones that we've talked about today are Disappearing Church and Reappearing Church. And if you're somebody who is interested in considering and meditating and thinking on what is the next few years of the church in the global West, what will be some of the dynamics of those movements and the things that we should be prepared for and mindful of, then we would encourage you to check out those books. If there's anything else that you heard us talk about in the show that you'd like to know more about, you can find details on our website, tvcresources.net. We'd encourage you to check out Mark's great podcast with John Mark Comer, This Cultural Moment.
Yeah, that's been a big kind of cultural listening point for us at The Village over the last several months, where it's just become like a common language that we're talking about regularly.
Yeah, it's a tremendous resource. And so thank you for that work, Mark.
My absolute pleasure. It was great fun.
On our next episode, we'll continue to jump back in to the rhythm between going through the Apostles' Creed and through the Book of Acts. So we will see you next time. Grace and peace.